Hello, this is Keith Caldwell with Failure to Plan. I'm here interviewing Bernie Crooks. Bernie, say hello.
Hi, Keith. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us today. I was curious. I always like to start out when I interview people to just sort of ask the question of how you came to be in this community and what your background is and why you decided to specialize in elder law and special needs law.
Well, I've always had a soft spot, even as a kid, growing up when we used to go away and I'd see someone in a wheelchair or not able to help themselves. It always bothered me, and in my eyes, it seemed like, they weren't getting a fair shake. And then when I became an attorney, I started out doing tax law and helping people strategize their investments. So that with a goal towards tax avoidance. Then about 25 years ago, I left that firm and started practicing elder law and special needs law. This is way before it became a popular area of the law. And I got great satisfaction out of being able to help people accomplish their goals with respect to providing for loved ones and making sure that they've got the best quality of life possible. And it always appealed to me to be able to do that and interact with people and see how we could make a difference. And then in 1996, my son Max was born, and he's got cerebral palsy, and I got a chance to see firsthand what it was like to be a parent, and that even raised my empathy and intensity and passion for this area to a whole nother level. So I'm committed to the cause and willing to do whatever it takes to make the world a better place for people with special needs.
Oh, we really appreciate it. How old is your son?
Max is going to be 17 in August.
Oh, that's going to segue in nicely to a question I'm going to ask you a little bit later. So, your firm, Littman Crooks, specializes in elder law and other things. What else does it do?
Well, we specialize in elder law, we specialize in special needs planning, and we specialize in special education advocacy, which is helping kids with special needs get a appropriate education. And we also have a practice in corporate and securities work in our New York City office.
Excellent. So you guys are licensed out of New York. Do you work in other states or you work with other attorneys in different states?
Our firm, Keith, has been very fortunate to develop a national reputation. So while our primary practice is in New York, in many cases we are hired as consultants to other lawyers or financial planners in all states across the country. I mean, currently working on cases in California, Florida, Idaho, where we will review some of the work of other lawyers who may not be so specialized in this area, and this way we can help impact families all across America.
Excellent, excellent. That's good information. As a parent of a child with special needs, my son is just turned 9. He's autistic and he has apraxia, so he's not able to speak very well, and people who don't know him don't really recognize what he's trying to say. What would you say from your experience, Bernie, is the hardest thing or the most difficult things for parents to get started with a plan?
Unfortunately, there's a period of denial.
Yes.
I think it affects us guys more than it does the moms. So, want to figure out, how we're going to help solve the problem. But in any event, I think it generally does affect all parents for some period of time where, how did this happen to me? What did I do wrong? This is not going to be the way it's going to be. Somehow it'll get better. So over a period of time, you begin to realize that, well, it is what it is. And now you have to stop thinking about how did we get here, but what are we going to do to make the future better? So you got to start looking out the front windshield instead of the rearview mirror. So to me, that's the most difficult thing when we're working with families, is to hope for the best but plan for reality. And just because you put a plan in place doesn't mean it can't be altered or changed if the person's condition changes over time, improves, or whatever. So to me, that's been the biggest challenge, is accepting the fact that it is what it is, and then doing your best to make it as good as it can be.
Excellent, excellent. You had written an article once about the five steps that you would suggest that parents take, and I think they were in order of prepare a letter of intent, create a will, create a special needs trust, create or sign advance directives, and obtain guardianships. So what is a letter of intent, and what's its purpose, and is it a legal document?
Well, no. See, that's the best thing about the letter of intent, Keith, and it certainly is the most important one. It's a roadmap to all the things that you do on behalf of your child or loved one, things that you may take for granted. We had some parents, and we actually did this at home too, write down every single thing you do for your child, things like which side does he like to sleep on, stomach, back, left side, right side, one pillow, two pillows, no pillows, does he go to sleep with the TV on, TV not on, what time does he wake up? When does he take his medication? Does he take it with a pill? Does he take it with liquid medication? So all the things you do that you might take for granted just because you do it as second nature, you got to imagine you got hit by a milk truck and tomorrow you're not here. And someone
right.
who doesn't even know your child, or may know your child but not the way you do, is now going to be you. And there's not a darn thing you can do about it. So the best thing we think you can do is draft this letter of intent, which needs to be changed. We have our clients review it annually and make sure it covers every single thing. And the only way you can do that is if you carry, in the old days we'd carry a piece of paper around, but now people carry their phones and they make the notes on the phones, of all the things you do for your child that may not be so obvious to a new person who would take over, and it will hopefully help them get a better understanding of a child, the things that he or she likes, and will hopefully lead to less disruption in that child's quality of life when you're not here. So that, to me, is A number one.
You know, that's a good question. I had read or seen someone who had suggested for the letter of intent is to maybe videotape some of your morning processes. For example, my son has a particular way that he likes to, you know, to put his lotion on and stuff like that. So I had my son, other son, videotape the morning routine, if you will, so someone can actually see it and see, oh, this is how he likes to do it. Because if you do it differently than he likes, he gets a little upset, and you don't necessarily know why. So that might be a good thing for people to add on, too, with this new technology that's out.
I think that's a great idea, Keith, and I appreciate you bringing it to my attention, because a lot of the kids, you know, can't communicate or don't communicate
right.
the way you and I do. So you might not even know something's wrong. You might know something's wrong, but you don't know what it is.
Exactly.
So, yeah, that will be very helpful. Thank you.
Good, good. The other thing you had mentioned is to create a will. Everyone knows what a will is, but is that particularly important to parents with special needs kids?
Critically important, because many kids with special needs are not able to manage their own investments. Many kids who are typical are not able to because of young age.
Many adults, Ernie.
Just magnified when you have special needs, whether physical or emotional, whatever they might be, neurological. So you want to make sure without a will, the assets are going to go in accordance with the laws of the state that you live in. And the money might, or your assets might not go to the people who you would want. And everybody has a right, everybody over 18 has a right to make their own will. And then your wishes are respected with respect to who gets your property. So it's critical that you have a will to make sure the people who you want to inherit your property actually do so.
Excellent, excellent. Now, is there a portion of that also that talks about the special needs trust? Because if the assets go to a child, it might disqualify them for other benefits?
Yeah, I see a lot of kids are receiving Medicaid or SSI or some other type of government benefit that pays for their health care or might pay for their housing or residential setting. Excuse me. And in order to be eligible for those benefits, you have to qualify financially for these government benefit programs. And without a special needs trust, the parents' assets can be left to the child outright, and would trigger a loss of those benefits, which could be catastrophic because the kid's relying on those benefits for housing and health care. So what a special needs trust allows the parents to do is place the assets in this trust where it doesn't disqualify the child for the benefits, but it can improve the child's quality of life by paying for things that the government benefit programs don't pay for. Because let's face it, the government is running out of money and things are only going to get worse in the future, it looks like, with respect to government finances. So we need to do whatever we can from a private sector standpoint to make sure there are funds available to make sure that the children have the best quality of life possible. So the way to do that is take what the government gives you in the government benefit programs, but supplement it with the special needs trust that'll help enhance and pay for things that the government does not cover.
Okay, good. That makes a lot of sense. Advanced directives, what are they and why do we need them?
Well, an advanced directive is something where you appoint somebody else to make medical or financial decisions for you in the event you're incapacitated. And these are things that parents ought to have because a lot of times the parents are so caught up in being caregivers for the child, they forget to take care of their own needs. So it's very important that you appoint someone to make medical and financial decisions for you in the event you're incapacitated. And also, a lot of people with special needs are able to sign their own advance directives. So once your child is 18, and I know you'll ask me about this next, you have to decide whether they need a guardian or whether or not they can execute their own advance directives. So the preference is always to have somebody execute their own advance directives. This way you get to appoint somebody else to make medical or financial decisions for you in the event you can no longer make them yourself.
Yeah, that does segue nicely to the next question I was going to ask you about is guardianship and conservatorship. I've heard them used, and as a lay person, I don't know the difference between the two, if there is a difference between the two, or if I need both of them, or if I need neither of them. Can you explain that a little bit to me?
Keith, a lot of this is very state-specific. And in one state, it might be called a guardian. In another state, it might be called a conservator. Some states have both. Generally speaking, a conservator is somebody who manages your property, and a guardian is somebody who manages your person, so they'll make medical decisions for you. And this is critically important as children age out to be 18, because while they're minors, the parents have the right to make medical decisions for the child, but once a child turns 18, the parents will no longer have the authority due to HIPAA regulations, will no longer have the authority to make medical decisions or gain access to medical information on behalf of their child because they won't have authority. So a legal guardianship would give the parent the authority to gain access to this information and make medical decisions, and also in certain circumstances also give them access to the child's property. And a child, even a child with disabilities, could come into property through an inheritance, could come into property from a personal injury award. Maybe there was a malpractice case against a doctor or a hospital. Sometimes, you know, there's a high incidence of divorce in special needs families, so there may be child support. So there's a whole host of ways that a child with special needs can come into property. So the guardian will be in a position to manage that property and make financial and medical decisions for the child.
Now, you brought up a good point, divorce. I am a product of divorce, if you will. I was divorced a few years ago, and I know I've set up a special needs trust for my son and on my side of the family, but I don't know what's been done on her side of the family, nor do I know if any of her siblings or parents are planning to give any money to my son. I know that we wouldn't want him to get the money outright for the reasons you mentioned earlier, but is there any ideas or suggestions you can have relative to how to communicate with exes about your overall plan to engage them, to get them part of it? Any ideas on that?
One of the biggest things we can do is educate the matrimonial bar, because they are not skilled or knowledgeable in this area. And the more they're in tune to the issues, the more they'll bring in people like me and other lawyers like me across the country to get involved. And we've recently been involved in several cases, Keith, where the parents got divorced or in the process of getting divorced, and they have a child or more than one child with special needs, And both parents, while they may not agree on a lot, the one thing they do agree on is they want the kid to have the best quality of life. They may disagree on how to do it, but they share that common goal. So we have implemented special needs trust planning as part of our educational process with the matrimonial bar so that they're in tune to it. And at the end of the day, both parties have to want to do it. So it's not uncommon for the husband's lawyer to review the wife's trust and the wife's lawyer to review the husband's trust just to make sure that they're in compliance with the applicable laws and that they satisfy everybody's intentions and desires. Short of that, if the divorce is more acrimonious and there's no cooperation in that regard, then you're only going to be able to control your half of the property or your portion of the property, and then the ex-spouse would do what he or she wants with respect to that property, and it's quite possible that they may leave it outright to the child, and the child will be thrown off the government benefits. So I really believe if there's education, despite what's going on behind closed doors in the marriage and whatever acrimony there might be, if both parents are educated of the need to do the special needs planning, they can usually get past whatever other issues are out there for the benefit of the child and make sure that the proper planning is put in place.
Well, that is very, very innovative because I've not heard that yet, that you guys are working with lawyers who specialize in divorce, if you will, family law or whatever it's called, but to help educate them about why it's important for them to get their clients on one page as it relates to this child, this special child that they have, because it's going to have huge implications potentially when we're both no longer here to provide for that child, and neither one of us would want that.
Well, that's been our experience, that people going through a divorce don't agree on a lot, but this is one thing they can agree on.
Right. That's good to know. I'm gonna pick up the trumpet for you and sound that out and send people your direction about that because I think that's very, very important.
The place you need to do that, Keith, or where it will have the most value is if you had an introduction to somebody who was head of like the American Family Law lawyers section or the matrimonial law and make them understand how important it is and then they can trickle it down to their members.
That's a good point, and I will find out. I do have a lot of relationships with lawyers here in Sacramento area, some of them in that area, but I'm sure it's a very small community of lawyers, so I'm sure that I can get some direction in that way, but appreciate the suggestion. A couple other questions I have to ask you, I wanted to ask you. Tax raid on special needs trust are hugely ugly. Isn't it like anything over $11,000 is taxed at 35 or 38%?
It's actually worse than that. With the new tax legislation passed, implemented by our president and signed by the president and passed by Congress, special needs trusts are taxed at an alarmingly high rate, 45% approximately federally, on income above $11,950. Now, the good news is...
Sorry, I'm choking on that.
Yeah, it's a tough pill to swallow. I mean, 45%, it's insane. If you pay out if you put money in the trust and then pay it out to the kid, it's not taxed because it's money in and then money out. But if any money is placed in the trust and then it's invested and it earns interest or dividends or whatnot, you could be subject to a tax as high as 44.8%. on income above $11,950. So that is something that we previously didn't have to worry too much about. I mean, the threshold was always low. It was always about $11,000. It goes up a little bit by inflation each year. But due to the increase in the tax rates this past year, it's prohibitive to have too much income inside a special needs trust. So you really need to work with a tax lawyer or an accountant. And it's terrible that people in this situation would need to hire more professionals, but if you don't, almost half of your hard-earned dollars are going to go back to the government.
So I'm not a tax person, but I know that this is significantly important because we're all being pushed or encouraged to set up special needs trust, but on the other hand, we're going to get taxed at 45% and have a state tax in California, it's almost 10%. So 55% of the money it earns to help our kids is being sent to government coffers. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is what you're hearing, unless the money is spent. So if the money is spent, it's not taxed, but if it's accumulated, and you know, the last thing you want to do if you have a special needs trust is run out of money. Because if you're deceased and your kid's, a young adult at the time you pass away, the child can have a life expectancy of 50, 60, 70 more years, and you need to make sure that the money in that trust is available to pay for his or her needs the rest of his life. So it's very typical that these trusts will earn income. And I think we need to make sure that we have trustees of these trusts that are aware of the tax rules so that they invest in instruments that are very tax sensitive so that you pay the least amount of taxes possible.
That's definitely something we're going to have to dig into more another time. I know that you're pressed for time today. Is there any advice that you'd give a parent to get started, the things that they should do immediately, next steps for someone who just doesn't have a clue about what to do?
My biggest issue here is, having done this a long time, is that people do nothing. They have the deer in the headlights look and nothing happens because the whole task of doing this is daunting. It's overwhelming. I mean, plus you have all the therapies the kid's going to, the special education, the school issues. All of that consumes the parents, and they really don't have time to deal with the legal and financial stuff. But if that falls by the wayside, the effects could be catastrophic for you and the children. So what I suggest is, don't bite off more than you can chew. Take a step, do something. Establish a relationship with a financial planner, a lawyer, somebody who is knowledgeable in this area, and come up with a roadmap, even if it's going to take you a couple of years to get everything done. We have found, clients have communicated to us, that once they take a little step, they get a sense of relief and they realize how important it is, and then they'll take another one and another one, and then ultimately they have the plan in place. But if you look at it as this big gorilla that you're never going to be able to tackle, 5, 10 years go by and nothing gets done, and sometimes it's too late. We've had clients who are in their 40s, two kids with autism, got into a car accident, and they're gone, and now the two kids are there. Fortunately, they had done the planning, but I like to tell that story because you never know when it's going to be time.
You know, that's a good point, and I'll leave with this comment, is that I have a good friend of mine who does not have kids with special needs. She was at a wedding, videotaping the wedding, and as she's videotaping the wedding, you see the camera fall to the ground, and the camera is still running video, shooting straight up in the air. And you hear people running around saying, "Dee Dee, are you okay? Dee Dee, are you okay?" She had a brain aneurysm. And the only reason she lived, the doctor said, is because she had it at the wedding. If it would have been at home, she never would have made it. But she was there, so they were able to get EMT. And the result has been she's not able to get any new life insurance. The life insurance that they had on her was not enough. It was only $25,000, and now it's too late. So that example just motivated me to say, okay, if that were to happen to me and I was not lucky to live, I need to get that taken care of.
Look, whatever it is that motivates you, but that certainly is a good story.
Yes, okay. Well, Bernie, I don't want to hold you. I know you've got another appointment. I really, really do appreciate your time. Just give me 1 second. Let me stop the recording, and I'll be right back.